The word spinster didn't always have an unflattering meaning attached to it. It began as an honorable reference to unmarried women who spun thread for a living in 15th century Europe.
Our next guest is out to restore the word spinster. In her world, the word means leading a passionately lived, fully intentional life as a single woman.
Kate Bullock joins us now. She's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Kate, how would you describe what the word spinster means to you and how it evolved over the years for you?
To me, the spinster has always been an image of self-reliance and autonomy and even a kind of glamorous inscrutability. We don't know what the spinster is up to behind the closed doors of her home. And so she's free to be whoever she likes. And I don't know where I got that idea, but that's how I've always thought of her, of the spinster.
Well, your book grew out of a magazine article on being a single woman, and that really struck a nerve for a lot of people. And you found out while you were researching that you were really part of a growing demographic of women who choose not to marry and not to be in a formal partnership. How big a trend is that today?
Well, I would say it's not necessarily that women are choosing not to marry or rejecting marriage outright, although, of course, many women do, but it's more about how women are pushing marriage off and getting married later and have a more ambivalent relationship to the idea of marriage and don't necessarily organize their lives around it the way we have in the past.
So spinster to you is not something that you choose and you sort of brand yourself with it and that's you for the rest of your life. It's sort of the best choice for now.
I mean, that's one way of putting it. I would say that what I'm trying to get at in the book is that there is no one right way of doing things and that our romantic and domestic arrangements are all highly personal, individualized, and have been different at different points in history. People have always been questioning them and rearranging them. So we tend to think that there has been one right way or that marriage has always been the one and only way. And so not only is that not true, but I want people to walk away from the book just being aware of the variety of possibilities and that one needn't swear themselves to one way of being, that they're, you know, one could be single for 5 years and then get married or single for 15 years and get married or be married for 20 years and then become single.
Do we know what's driving the demographic of women choosing to put off marriage?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it's without a doubt the gains of the second wave of the women's movement. So all of the battles that were fought then have been, you know, the women of my generation and, you know, a couple of generations before me have been living out those gains. And we are, you know, pursuing careers and educations in higher numbers than ever before. So this has been going on for quite a while, but now the numbers have finally swelled to such a degree that it's a much more visible shift than it was. So it's been taking place, but sort of invisibly. And now that we have more than, you know, half of women are unmarried, it's just undeniable. We can't sideline the single experience the way that we once could.
And you write that early on, women are raised their whole lives, intentionally maybe or not, with two questions at the back of their mind, always sometimes at the front of their mind. Who am I going to marry and when am I going to marry them? What do you think is the consequence of growing up with those two questions always being present somehow?
I think that it over-prioritizes the importance of romantic love and then makes a person feel like a failure if they don't find it at a certain time. I think that a lot of a woman's self-worth can be erroneously invested in whether or not she's found someone. And it also sort of takes the light off of more or equal. I'm not denying the importance of love. I think love is a very important thing in a person's life, but also one's talents and ambitions and, you know, skills and strengths, these are all just as important. And instead, we tend to be, you know, society is telling young girls that marriage is the most important thing, not these other things, even though at the same time in schools we're, you know, trying to empower girls to pursue their own strengths and so forth.
And when your mother died, you, it sounds like, realized that those questions were not exactly how you wanted to frame your life anymore. How did you shift the way you started thinking about yourself and the path that lay ahead?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're bringing up that part of the book because, you know, I didn't realize that my mother and her death would be part of the book until I started writing it. And I was kind of dismayed because I wanted this to be a book of my 30s. I wanted it to be an adult book. And to realize that I had to start at the age of 23 when she died, because that's really when I started becoming an adult, and that in her death really absolutely shaped the way that I approached my adulthood. And that was with the feeling of, you know, she had been sort of a late bloomer. She had put her own ambitions to be a writer aside in order to raise my brother and me. I don't think she was at all tormented by her choices. She loved being a mother. She loved my father. But I felt and, you know, witnessed her frustration around work when she finally did start pursuing her writing ambitions in her late 30s. And then she, you know, sort of right as she was coming into her own and feeling the full measure of her powers, she got breast cancer and died at 52. And it was, you know, traumatized. I mean, you know, it was a terrible time. It was terrible to lose her. But it also made me feel so deeply how short life is, and that there isn't time to be making compromises, and that I knew that I wanted to try to become a writer, and that that would take a lot of work, and that that's the star I wanted to guide myself by. Sorry, go on.
And having lost your mother, you were pretty young still at that point, it sounds like you looked for women who could have those meaningful conversations about how to direct your life, and you found them, and you found them in other writers. They weren't present in your life except for through their writing. You call them awakers. Who were they?
Yeah, so they were Maeve Brennan, a mid-century essayist for The New Yorker, Neith Boyce, who was a journalist and novelist at the turn of the last century, who wrote a column for Vogue called The Bachelor Girl in the year 1898 about her decision to never marry, Edith Wharton, who became the famous grande dame and novelist we know her as only after she left her husband in her 40s and she lived alone for the rest of her life, Edna St. Vincent Millay, who in the early 1900s was America's most famous and iconic single woman before she ended up marrying and having an open marriage, and then Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the feminist writer and activist, also from the turn of the last century.
And what did you learn from exploring these women's lives and their choices?
Well, you know, I'd say, you know, I call them my awakeners, which is a term I borrowed from Edith Wharton, who used it in her memoir to describe the books and people who had guided her intellectual journey. And what these women did for me is I would, you know, I just found them in the course of my own reading. I would happen upon them, or a new biography would come out, and I would start these conversations with them in my head, and then I would start going in deeper. I'd go past the biography and find their letters and diaries or people who knew them, and really start learning about their lives. And they each taught me very different things that were all so highly, you know, personal or idiosyncratic, you know, what I took away from them. But what they all had in common was a very deliberate approach to their own lives, that they questioned their own motivations each step of the way, lived with great intention. And that's what I found ultimately most useful about from between all of them. That's what they were all very different women, but what they all had in common was great intentionality and deliberation, that they didn't take anything for granted or follow convention for the sake of it, but paused and thought about what was best for them, even if that meant reversing course and making a decision and deciding it was the wrong decision. You know, in the case of Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was born in 1860, she decided as a teenager, I'm never marrying. I want to change the world. I've got lots of things to do. I don't have time to get married. But then in her early 20s, fell in love with a man, and the only way to have sex during that time, in a non-scandalous way, was to be married. And so after 2 years of pushing him off, she finally succumbed to marriage and was in love with him, but, you know, was feeling physical desires, and then ended up getting pregnant and falling into America's most famous postpartum depression, which she immortalized in her story, The Yellow Wallpaper. And she decided after that, you know, this just isn't for me. I'm not supposed to be married. And so her husband married her best friend, and she and her husband shared custody of her daughter. You know, this was totally unheard of at this time in the late 1800s. And she was a public figure. People were so angry at her for doing this. She received a lot of censure. But, you know, what she did was spend the next 10 years of her life traveling around the country, calling herself a woman at large was her self-designation, lecturing on topics about how to change and improve women's lives. So, you know, I see her as very inspiring in that sense, that she knew what she wanted, she made a mistake, she corrected for the mistake.
It's interesting that you went back to these five women of earlier generations for kind of your role models and your guides. Do you think there are contemporary role models and guides? I'm thinking of Carrie Bradshaw, Sex and the City, or Ally McBeal, and they don't seem to have the same substance.
Right. I think that, you know, we're still in a moment that is not offering a lot of examples for how to be a single woman, and that the examples that are on offer are very narrow, urban, professional, kind of dating obsessed. I mean, I like both of those shows as shows, but I don't blame them for not. It's not the fault of the shows that we don't have enough varieties on offer. There just need to be more. So that's why, you know, I was feeling that paucity of options when I was, you know, in my late 20s and early 30s and looking back. And I knew that I would find guides and role models during the second wave of the women's movement. You know, there was an enormous public critique of marriage and conversation going on then. But I hadn't known about this same conversation going on at the turn of the last century. And so this finding it was very exciting and fresh to me. And the ways in which women were talking about their lives then was very personal and intimate because it was pre-ideological. Today, the conversation is encumbered with a lot of jargon and specific notes that need to be hit. But they were writing at a time before the conversation had been codified. So their voices felt more intimate to me. And then also, of course, the fact that they all lived a long time ago and were writers means that they, you know, there are records of the ways in which they were thinking about these questions that I think about. So there are plenty of women doing that now, but I don't have access to their diaries and email accounts. So I can't be reading the way that they think about it. And so that it was, you know, because these women lived so long ago and so much had been written about them and that they had left records behind, that I was able to create this internal conversation with them.
We're talking right now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. You can give us some insight into what's going on today. Are you part of this growing demographic of women who choose to be single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? And do you think society is ready to give equal standing to single women? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. Are you one of the growing number of women who choose to stay single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers now and take a call from Kate in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for both you and Kate. I'm young, personally, and I'm married, and I am expecting a child in September. And my question was, you know, I kind of always had this idea in my mind about getting married at a young age and then eventually, you know, having kids before 30. And I guess I was kind of wondering how biology kind of played a role in all of this, because that was just my idea, you know, having kids at 26, you know, and starting the family, because I feel like if I was to do it later, like how she was saying, that maybe it would be too late, you know?
Right. Great question, Kate. Thank you for bringing that up. The biological clock, does that play sort of an imperative role in some of this? Because there are options, as you say, and you want women to know the options they have and to explore them. But there are certain things you can't work around, like how long you can have babies.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a great question. And it's I happen to be one of the people who never had a strong desire to have children. So that made it easier for me to be more ambivalent about marriage because I just was ambivalent about starting a family as it was. But then what's also interesting right now about this new day and age in which we live is assisted reproductive technologies and how that's changing the landscape as well. And so, you know, once upon a time, a spinster, the classic definition was an unmarried, childless woman past her prime. And now I just wrote an article for Cosmopolitan magazine about the rise of single mothers by choice and women who are choosing to have children on their own. So that's adding a new twist to this whole changing demographic. And I sometimes, in a sort of utopian, idealistic way, I wish that we could totally rechange society so that women were having babies at their biological baby-making prime between the ages of 18 and 25. And so we could all have babies then and then, you know, have college and careers set up, you know, and then our mothers are retiring just in time to be taking care of the children or something, you know. But it's very complicated working this all out. And we still, you know, America is so behind the rest of the Western world in the ways in which we don't support working mothers. So it does make it really hard for women to be figuring out how to map out their lives.
Thank you so much for that call, Kate. Appreciate that. We have an open line at 800-642-1234. And Kate's question reminds me, I read some of the conversation that was started up because of your book, and there were some married women with children who wrote to say, this is so interesting. I'm very thoughtful about this because I feel as though my life is unfolding in a way that maybe I would have thought differently about if I'd read this book first, and I'm going to think about it and watch what happens. You get a lot of response from women who have chosen marriage and children who are thinking differently about their lives.
I do, yeah. I hear from everybody in all kinds of situations, and it's, I write early in the book, I was reading Milan Kundera, and he had some line about women. I was struck by the idea that women seem to often be running away from their lives once they had created them, and that why couldn't we be figuring it out beforehand or having that time on our own beforehand? Why were we leaving husbands and children behind in order to find that, like at least in novels or something? But yeah, I do hear from lots of women saying that this is, yeah, they wish they could have thought about things a little bit differently, and that is great for me to hear, because what I'm also loving is hearing from young women in their early 20s saying, oh, thanks, this is showing me the possibilities, the range of ways to think that I hadn't thought of before, and which is exactly what I want. And the other thing I want a reader to do is to be thinking about her own awakeners, that the women I write about in the book are the ones who were most useful to me, but just like life itself is a very individuated process of making what it, you know, should be, I think that finding your own awakeners is really useful, and that we each have our own.
Now, other responders to your book said things that were more challenging. They said, you know, sure, she's glamorous now, and she's got a book, and she's beautiful. Wait till she's older. Then it's not going to be such a selling prospect for people to think about. What do you think about that kind of critique?
I find that frustrating and limiting, because it's complicated critique, because, you know, there I am on the cover of this book, you know, a hair stylist and makeup stylist, you know, I've been totally dolled up and look a lot more glamorous than I actually am in my everyday life, right? But also, I'm not choosing, this isn't about rejecting marriage or rejecting love. It's about finding how to balance love and autonomy is what the central conflict of my own adult life has been. So that critique, I think, comes from people who haven't actually read the book.
Well, Kate, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kate Bullock is a contributing editor to The Atlantic, and she's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about this, about your own life experiences, your own life choices, whether you're a man or a woman. Have you, do you think, fully explored the possibilities and times in your life when you were partnered and unpartnered? And what did you find to be sort of the gifts of both of those times of lives? Call us at 800-642-1234 or at this point, go to our Facebook page. You can leave your comments there.